Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, March 17th, 2014. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And a top of the morning to you.
Oh, right. It's St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
It's a day for some green beer and a little cabbage and corned beef. Maybe a couple of pops.
Pops?
Yeah, of alcohol.
Oh, I see. Irish whiskey.
Irish whiskey.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. So thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, how far do you think Big Pharma will go to market its drugs?
And are college athletes abused by universities?
And how are computers ruining the doctor-patient relationship?
So can fish help you sleep?
That's a good one. I thought it was turkey, but now it's fish, huh?
Well, maybe we could put an aquarium in the bedroom.
Good idea. A sleeping fish, that's it, huh? And how inadequate sleep in adolescents can compromise their future health.
A drug for this and a drug for that. You know, there must be a drug for just about everything that ails us, at least if you believe the ads. Now,
sure.
Pharmaceutical ads do work, and people even ignore the possible side effects. Big Pharma increased their marketing efforts to $98 million just in the District of Columbia. Now, there have been efforts to curb Big Pharma from giving gifts to doctors. We've talked about it many times before. But according to a recent report, they have now increased their budget for doctors and other healthcare providers, as well as for grants, speaker fees, food, promotional items. Major expenditures go to hospitals, clinics, universities, organizations, direct-to-consumer ads, representatives, and it goes on and on and on.
Right. Well, you're looking at a $400 billion a year industry whose goal is to have return on investment. That's what pharmaceutical companies are. They're businesses that people invest in, and they expect to make money, and that's why they put stock in it.
Well, according to this article, speaker fees, some of them are like $100,000 to the speakers.
Well, probably for the year, if they give a number of speeches, but even so, that's a huge number.
That's quite a profession.
Well, yes. I mean,
they wouldn't have to do any other kind of work.
Well, they probably have large incomes. I mean, some doctors are making more than $1 million a year, and it comes from a whole lot of different resources. But anyway, this study was done at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, and as you said, they showed that just in the District of Columbia for the year 2012, they spent $97.5 million marketing pharmaceuticals to the District of Columbia. It's a lot of money. And about $30 million of that, which is about 31% of it, took the form of payments and gifts to physicians and hospitals and other healthcare providers, as you were saying.
Yeah, which they're not supposed to keep doing.
Well, not like that. They're supposed to disclose it. But the problem is there aren't any real transparencies that force the companies to disclose exactly what they're doing. So they've still got loopholes where they can hide this. But as this is becoming required by the Affordable Care Act, to have more disclosures, you're going to see less money being pumped into doctors and more into doctors' organizations.
And to hospitals and clinics and
universities. Absolutely, because they need to have money coming in, and they need to be able to pump their drugs up, particularly if they don't have any new big revelations with new drugs. So they have to find a way to continue to make the incredible amount of money that they are, or that CEO and that board of directors is going to be out.
Well, I was surprised at the amount of money that they spend for the direct-to-consumer ads every year. And
else
is interesting is that direct-to-consumer ads are banned in all other countries except for New Zealand.
Well, that's right.
And it's like $5 billion.
Well, there's a lot, and there's a tremendous return on that investment. Well, they have actually three different types of advertising, and one type is the one that most countries will not allow, and that's really where they can make a product claim ad that mentions the product and its indication and includes its efficacy and safety claims. And that's what we're seeing on these direct-to-consumer ads that we see. And that's only allowed here in New Zealand. But in other countries, there are a few places where they allow them to disclose the name of the product or indications for it, but not both. Because what happens is we wind up convincing people through those ads that they should be using this drug.
Remember when the purple pill ad first came out?
Oh, sure.
And nobody knew what it was
they
or what the
it.
Name of it was. They just called it the purple pill.
Right.
One-eyed, one-horned, yeah. Flying purple people here. Well, you know, there are a lot of people, maybe young people, don't even know about that ad because that was really when they first started.
Well, a lot of these started back in 1981 when they were marketing the immunization for pneumonia. Merck was trying to get people to and doctors to use Prevnar, which is a vaccine against pneumococcal pneumonia strains. And then a couple of years later, they came out with ads for Advil. And for Motrin.
Well, because they knew that they were working.
Well, they had an idea that it would. And then, of course, it turned out to be a huge boon. And now you're looking at spending $5 billion a year. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money.
I remember when they first came out and I was saying to you, how can they do this? I didn't know that they could advertise drugs on television. Like
well,
that.
That's right. It's sort of like advertising alcohol or tobacco. You know, that suddenly becomes something that they're not allowing.
Well, these ads can be pretty misleading and deceptive, you know. And two, they just foster the idea that people think they can just pop a pill for anything that ails them.
Well, that's the idea. And, of course, that's what we teach our doctors, too. And when they're in medical school, and don't think for a minute that the pharmaceutical industry doesn't have a huge effect on medical school education and research, because there's a enormous conflict of interest.
And how often do the doctors tell the patient what the side effects are from the pill?
Well, the major ones they tend to do because you have to cover yourself. If somebody has an effect of a drug that's negative and you haven't told them about it, you're open for a lawsuit. And I've seen some interesting lawsuits where doctors have been sued because something happened that they didn't mention to them. And, of course, that's right, but at the same time, the doctor's trying to follow the advice of the pharmaceutical industry, of the medical boards, of the standard of practice in the area, and it involves taking a lot of risks when we're using drugs.
Well, I know somebody that is having a minor surgical procedure, and I went with her to a doctor's appointment the other day,
mm-hmm.
And when she filled out all the forms in the waiting room, she wrote, you know, they ask you all these questions about your health history and everything. And so she said that she had pre-ulcer conditions.
Uh-huh.
So right away the doctor says after the procedure to take a Motrin.
Right.
And I said, but she's got pre-ulcer conditions, you know. She's like, but it's an anti-inflammatory.
Oh, right.
But it's like, why even have her fill out the form if she's not even going to pay attention to it?
Well, think of it this way. The doctors are interested in the effects of the drug that are positive, and they want to minimize the problems with it. And,
so, okay, and so it's an anti-inflammatory, and she could bleed to death.
Yeah, that's true. But you have to look at the risks and the percentages. They're fairly low. Maybe 1% of people or 5% of people are going to have something that you could take some note of, but the other 95% to 99% are going to do just fine.
But
so
listen, all the things she gave her in prescription
mm-hmm.
could cause the same problem. That's could all irritate her stomach.
Well, that's right.
The antibiotic could hurt her stomach,
yep.
too. The Tylenol with codeine could hurt her stomach.
Yep.
All those things could make you bleed.
Yeah, well, but you have to understand, and I know you do, so this is not directed at you, Vicki, but that's the way the medical profession thinks. It's sort of like we give a drug because we want somebody to not have a certain complication or a certain effect, or we want them to improve from the symptoms that they have. But it's not looking at the underlying causes.
Well, the other thing that bothered me was that she'd filled out on there that she took fish oil.
Uh-huh.
And the doctor didn't say one thing to her about stopping the fish oil before the procedure.
Right.
I told her to not take the fish
right,
oil.
Right, because it actually could make her bleed a little bit more from the wisdom tooth extractions.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, but that's kind of like the way that it is in the profession. It's what we do. It's how we're trained. And then we come out and we do it that way. And the problem is that there are a lot of things that happen to people because of the expected effects of the drug in a small number of people. We call those, quotes, side effects. But they're not side effects at all.
They're adverse effects.
Well, they are, but they are also expected effects.
Yeah, we know that
happens. We know that about 100,000 people a year, just in hospitals alone, die from the expected side effects of a drug when it's used properly. That's a staggering number. Think of how many people outside the hospital have that as well.
Well, and plus they're taking more than one drug.
Well, that's right.
I mean, look at this. Just for this one simple procedure, she gives her prescriptions for
four things.
For three, this, you know.
Zofran as well, for in case she got nauseated.
Isn't
from the codeine.
Three things? Okay. Codeine, Zofran,
Motrin.
And then she wanted her to do that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a making for problems. And, of course, my way of thinking is those teeth didn't actually need to come out to start with, which is another story.
That's another story.
Right.
Okay, so anyhow, in 2012, that was the first spending increase since 2007 for the pharmaceutical companies.
First increase that was measured, that's
for
right.
For marketing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they found was modest gifts, like the little personal gifts, like around $25 or whatever.
Sure, they give you a pen or they give you a pad.
But that those foster loyalty.
Well, they do. I mean, whenever somebody buys you something, you feel a little indebted. And, of course, you have to look at the personality of the drug reps. Or at their physical appearance. And a lot of the time, what are we talking about? Is some young chick that looks great, all right, that may have a low-cut dress on and a little high skirt, comes into the office, and next thing you know, she's sitting in the doctor's office, and they're talking about, oh, we're having a little get-together at one of the fancy restaurants. Would you like to come? We'll buy you dinner. And
bring your wife.
Yeah, do all that and bring your friends. Yeah, sure. But, I mean, the return on that investment is huge. When they're looking at the numbers that are involved there, for every dollar that they spend on things like that, they get 2 to 4 times an amount in return in profit.
Well, they must if they're paying the speakers that much money.
Well, I mean, talking about just in the District of Columbia for that
yeah,
1 year, almost $100 million. I mean, that's a staggering number, and there are only about 10,000 doctors in the District of Columbia. So you're looking at a lot of money that's spent there.
And the researchers that wrote this article, they're afraid of this large-scale marketing because they say it could lead to drugs being prescribed more than what's appropriate.
Well, so, you know that's what's going to happen because that's the whole intent. In fact, that's why a lot of the drugs are privately supported by the drug reps. They'll say, well, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but because you're my friend, I'll let you know that we're doing some research on these other effects of this same drug, and you might want to be thinking about using it for that, although I'm not supposed to tell you. And, of course, they just did tell you, and your mind is going to be working if you're thinking in terms of pharmaceutical solutions, and you might be inclined to try it if you don't have a better solution.
Yeah, a lot of these drugs are used for off-label.
About 20% of the prescriptions that are written are for off-label use of a drug. That's an enormous thing, which means it's not approved by the FDA at all. Not that we should trust our FDA. I mean, we can't do that either. So what we've got is a system that needs to be changed because it's not right.
Okay, so they mentioned all these ways that they spend money for marketing, and they get down to the last $61 million.
Right.
And they say other marketing.
Yeah, well,
they don't even tell you what that is.
That's because they don't want you to know. If they wanted you to know, they would have told you.
And when it says organizations, they don't say what organizations.
No,
I mean, there are a lot of pretty big, powerful organizations in the medical profession.
Well, you're looking at the specialty groups. Maybe it's for the orthopedists, or it's for the allergists, or the immunologists. Or
American
for the
American Cancer Society.
Could be any of those.
Could be.
Absolutely. So you're looking at a ton of money.
And all this money, yeah, and all this money that we're talking about is just in Washington, D.C.
Right. Well, you look at the $5 billion that's spent in direct-to-consumer ads and how they're trying to persuade the public as well as the doctors in all the advertising they do. It's just simple business. It's not anything particularly about a service. When you look at the new drugs that are coming out from a pharmaceutical company, most of them are very similar to other drugs that are in the same family.
It's just because the others have run out of their patents.
So a drug, say it's an ACE inhibitor, something like lisinopril that's used to treat hypertension. There are probably another 10 or 15 drugs that are just like it, but they come out and they're brand new, and they're advertised and say, oh, they have this other slightly minor difference in that they think is an advantage, or they portray it that way. And the next thing you know is the doctors are saying, yeah, there's a new drug out. Let's try it and see if it works.
And then the patient thinks, oh, it's a new drug.
Right.
It's better. It's better than the other one. Let's take that.
Well, in actuality, the best drugs are the ones that have been around for 50 years, and you can't even trust that.
Because those have been being tested on people.
Well, I mean, look at a drug like Darvon that was around for 50 years. It was taken off the market a couple of years ago because it was found to cause some lethal heart effects in some people.
That's pretty scary. Sometimes I wonder how I survived. You know, I used to take Darvon for menstrual cramps when I was young.
Yeah, sure. Well, there are a lot of... You look at the drugs when they're fast-tracked through... About 20%, meaning they're brought to market quicker, which makes a lot more money for the drug company because now it's being sold sooner than it would have been. A lot of those drugs within 2 or 3 or 4 years are either black box warnings because they found out new things about them that are terrible, or have been removed from the market because they were found to cause disastrous problems that kill people. So what we want is for the pharmaceutical companies to do their research and to be honest about the way they present it, which, of course, is also another issue, and we don't have that.
Well, I think it's unethical that they can spend all this money on ads to bribe people, you know, like they're bribing the doctors and the hospitals, and they're making all these organizations and so forth feel indebted to them.
Well, I mean... That's simple business, but what you're saying and what I agree with is that it's good that we know about drugs and what they do, but it's not good that the drug is portrayed to be better than it is, and that the so-called side effects are not that bad and not to be worried about so much. When you listen to the second half of a direct-to-consumer ad, all of a sudden the speed of the voice that's telling you about all the side effects goes way up, and almost too fast to be able to listen to, and we tend to block it out.
Because they have all the pretty pictures in the background.
Sure.
And the video of...
And then we found out about human nature. You know, a few weeks ago, we talked about the fact that if a company disclosed the side effects, that people still bought into it a few months later.
Okay.
Initially, they might not want to use a particular drug if you're telling them that it could have problems. But 3 months later, they're thinking, oh, this company is being honest with me. They're telling me the truth.
Yeah.
And they just look at the effect, the positive effect of what the drug does, and buy it. And it's like blowing our minds to think about that, because it seems like, well, that's really stupid, isn't it? But we do it anyway, because it's sort of unconsciously what we do to get to where we are. So it's... This whole business of the business of medicine taking over for the service of medicine is a big disaster. And we need to change our healthcare system. It needs to be shifted to service as well as wellness and prevention. Looking at lifestyle is our first approach to trying to help keep people well. These are the things that we should be focused on, not what new pharmaceutical drug is going to be coming out and what kind of effect that it's going to have, because it's got these slightly different effects than the parent drug did that lost its patent.
And we're so fortunate that there are alternatives for many of these drugs that are natural remedies.
Oh, for sure. I hardly use drugs in my practice anymore because I don't need them. The first thing I do is lifestyle. The second thing we do is we use natural things that are much less likely to cause problems, and then we start looking at using drugs and surgeries and technologies. It's about that simple. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on everyday products in your home that can be making you sick. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, are young college athletes being abused by universities?
Everyday products in your home can be making you sick. If you suffer from insomnia or allergies, digestive disorders, headaches, skin problems, body pain, frequent colds, even weight gain and hormonal issues or fatigue, All those things could be caused by the products that you use inside your home. And if you really want to get healthy, you need to begin by taking just small steps to make your home toxin-free. So it's not that hard, but what you need to do is to just start by first becoming aware of what goes in you and on you and surround you, and that it has a high impact on your health and your well-being. Because your food, your water, your personal care products, your makeup, your cleaners, even your vitamins can contain untested chemicals and additives. And a lot of these chemicals have been banned in many other countries, but they're available here in the U.S. without them even putting warning labels on them. Plus, you're being bombarded by dangerous, untested electromagnetic fields from cordless phones, cell phones, microwaves, and even the wiring that are in our walls. And our government doesn't regulate these things, so we have to be responsible ourselves. And if you feel confused about some of these practical things that you can do to minimize your exposure and maximize your health, my next tip, I'm going to get you started to reduce your environmental toxins, and we'll talk about things like artificial sweeteners and organic produce and food additives and chemical-free cosmetics and personal care products and synthetic fragrances. I have a lot more things, too, that I'm going to try to include in that. So,
well, you learned all this the hard way. You know, back in the early 90s and the late 1980s, you were really sick with allergies to so many things that were in skincare products and cosmetics and
food and pesticides,
cleaning agents, and we tested you and found those things, and they were causing anaphylactic reactions, in which you had to give yourself injections of adrenaline to be able to survive from. So you've become an expert in
this. Also, there's somebody whose name is Beth Greer.
She's fantastic.
And she has a book called Supernatural Home.
Mm-hmm. And highly recommend.
She's part of this group called Optimal Living. It's a website, mm-hmm. and they do online live stream classes. In fact, she's going to be talking about these things. But she started out, she had like a tumor. It was a benign tumor, but it was like the size of a grapefruit or a baseball under her arm, mm-hmm. in her armpit. And she just on her own thought she would clean up her lifestyle, and she did, and the thing disappeared.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of people have their stories. But we have a lot of this information also on drsaputo.com under Vicky's Corner.
Right. There's a lot of free information if you just go to Vicky's Corner that you'll want, because it tells you what you can buy. It's got the 800 numbers and also has the websites. It's a very, very useful bit of information that I hand out in my office all the time.
So my next tip at 22 the hour will be on the rest of this. Now, Division I athletes, these are the hotshot athletes in college, the best ones. They
right.
might be sacrificing their future health-related quality of life for a brief athletic career in college. So picture this, a healthy, fit, popular college athlete submitting him or herself to serious injury. Does this make sense?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, what we'll do to be able to be socially accepted and shine and to be looked at as somebody that we look up to, are the athletes.
They get a scholarship.
Oh, a lot of them. They get a free ride. Sure. They get all kinds of things. Then they get into professional sports of one type or another. And really, these people are being used in many ways. I think it's a lot of it's about money from the point of view of the university or the professional sports. And athletes are really used as commodities.
Well, this Indiana University study found that elite college athletes often suffer physical and emotional limitations in middle and old age, mm-hmm. as a result of injuries during their athletic career.
Yeah.
This is so ironic, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this was published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine in March of 2014. And they basically showed that people who were not elite athletes in college but kept themselves fairly fit were the ones that did the best, because they had fewer injuries that took them out, meaning they wouldn't be able to do much in the way of exercise later because of a severe injury of one type or another.
It's just really sad. I mean, here they are, young, and they're healthy, and they're popular, mm-hmm. and then they end up disabled and depressed and fatigued, along with having sleep problems and the inability to even exercise. And then they end up overweight with diabetes and heart attacks, and they need joint replacements, and they have pain, and they're often on multiple medications.
Well, it goes on and on. You're right. When you look at former Division I athletes, they're actually twice as likely as non-athletes, meaning ones that didn't play for their university, to report physical activity limitations. And 67% of the athletes reported sustaining a major injury, and 50% reported chronic injuries, as opposed to only 28% of people who were keeping fit but not doing athletics for the university had a major injury, and 26% only had an injury that was a chronic injury.
They were talking on the news this weekend about this last weekend about concussions and how common those are, and the lasting effects from those, and people's balance is off and their vision can be affected.
Right, you want the classic example. Look at Muhammad Ali, you know, the great, maybe the greatest boxer of all time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he had injuries that have given him Parkinson's disease. It's a real disaster. And look at all the other contact sports that there are that can be a problem.
Football always comes to mind.
Football, sure. Anything, or hockey, or games where there's collision between.
Look at gymnastics.
As well, that's right.
And surfing, and I don't know if they do that in college. Do they have that as a?
Well, I'm sure some colleges have some surfing, sure. But even if it's not,
skateboarding is really dangerous.
Well, there was another article published in one of the big journals on people who were having head and neck injuries as well. In fact, it was reported at the 2014 annual meeting of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And they said that it was the extreme sports that were causing a lot of problems with head and neck injuries.
We just got through watching the Olympics too, huh?
Oh, and seeing some of the things that the crashes and the problems that the risks that these people take, and while they're heroic in so many ways, and we look up to them for their remarkable skills, when you're looking at the overall picture of what happens during their lives. I mean, a lot of these people, you have a head or a neck injury that's a big deal. I mean, that could take you out.
Well, the snowboarding and the skiing.
Skateboarding and motocross and mountain biking and surfing, snowmobiling and even snow skiing, the extreme skiing. You know, two of our kids are extreme skiers that compete. And every time they go off to a competition, I just kind of hold my breath and say a prayer, because it's such a big thing that, I mean, they could be taken out, let alone just injured.
So, you know, I guess they figure it's worth it. I mean, you can't live your life in fear of injury all the time.
No. There's a balance someplace.
And it's sort of like, too, you know, like when they're the athletes, a lot of them have coaches and nutritionists to guide them and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, it's kind of like they're trading one type of crutches for another type of crutches.
Well, that's really right. I mean, look at what's happening in some of the major sports that bring in a lot of money to the university. I mean, they're shooting up these kids who have injuries with steroids, and they're using painkillers like lidocaine.
Yeah, and they can play when they're injured.
Well, then there's not enough time, really, to let those things heal. So the amount of suffering that they're going to have from that down the road is huge. It's not really a big surprise that you see all these changes in people who are athletes.
Some people might not realize that osteoarthritis can occur from an earlier joint trauma.
Oh, for sure.
And a lot of these sports require repetitive stress. Just think of baseball or a pitcher, for example,
sure.
You know, doing the same movement all the time.
Repetitive stress is a big deal.
Yeah,
that's
and
right.
Back problems. And anyway, the list just goes on. But there are healthier choices if maybe you want to just be recreationally active.
Well, there's no question about that. What I'm picking up from this is that the universities, yeah, it's good to have competitive meets. I mean, the athletics have been a big thing. The Olympics have been a huge thing as far back as I can remember. And yet at the same time, the price that we pay for it, if things don't turn out right, is huge. So maybe there's a balance in there somewhere where it's not the big extreme thing that we make it.
Well, it's also important to stay active for your whole life, to have a good quality
Absolutely.
Of life. But a lot of these Division I sports are not lifelong sports, so it's important for athletes to find sports to keep them active as they age.
Sure, and even in those, even sports like tennis, you know, which I do, I see people playing well into their 80s and 90s. There are very few tennis players after age 60 don't have some kind of injury, but they're fit and they live longer. All right, it's time for a station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about how computers are ruining the doctor-patient relationship. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
Aren't computers grand?
They do a lot of good things, don't they?
Can you even remember life without them? They can certainly save us a lot of time. And on the other hand, they can waste a lot of time. So I can get so frustrated when my computer has problems or I have problems with it.
Indeed.
And they can interfere with our personal relationships.
Too much time on the computer, huh?
Well, or if you want to interrupt somebody that's on the computer.
Ah.
And also, they can improve our relationships online.
For sure.
With our friends online. I really like it that way because then you can keep in touch with people easier.
Oh, and then there's Skype and ways of doing conference calling. I mean, there are a lot of ways that it brings us closer together with people that live far away. But for people that are close to us,
it's not nice to do it when you're with somebody. You know, sometimes you're with people like children or grandchildren or whatever, whoever it is, and they're sitting with you at the dinner table or wherever, and they don't have computer etiquette.
Right. You're right.
So where do electronic health records fit in? So how do you feel when you go to the doctor and he or she spends at least a third of your appointment time looking at the computer screen?
Well, things have changed a lot in medicine, and that's why that happens. I mean, we have a one-size-fits-all model for a lot of what happens in a regular office visit. The government now wants to know what we do, what drugs we use or what techniques we use or have we done the right strategies according to what they think is going to be reimbursable. A lot of one-size-fits-all stuff is going to take away that individuality, that special relationship where the doctor and the patient are going beyond information exchange to what I call connection.
Of course, you know, I don't know how much different it really is because I haven't been to a doctor that's used it yet or to you using it yet. But
well, I use it all the time in my office.
I mean, doctors used to do it with the chart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like if the doctor's got his face in the chart while you're sitting in the room, it's sort of the same thing, only on the computer screen you can look at it with the doctor, I guess.
Well, I guess you can.
And when it's the chart, you don't really get to look at it with the computer. But I love to tell this story. I've told it before, but if you're a new listener.
Yeah.
Because one time I took my parents to the doctor, and this particular doctor was somebody that was in your call group.
Yeah, a good friend for 25, 30 years.
Yeah, so I really caught him. So we went to go see him. The three of us went in the room, and it was about my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks into the room, doesn't look at us. He's got the chart in his hand. He turns his back to us, puts the chart on this little elevated
on the counter
that slants up, you know, and he starts to talk, or you know, he's reading it, and I don't know, he started to talk or something, and I said, "Hi, so and so."
Yeah, right.
And he turns around because I called him by his first name, and he turns around, and he goes, "Oh, Vicki, hi."
Yeah.
And I said, "This is my mom and dad," and da-da-da-da-da, and I wanted to say, gotcha.
Because yeah, right.
That is really not good bedside manner. Not that it was a bedside.
Well, it's so impersonal. I mean, it's like this is a sterile relationship where we're exchanging information, and that's where it ends.
I mean, the first thing the doctor should do is to greet you.
Well, you would think.
To say hello, maybe shake your hand, whatever, but not to walk in and not say anything.
I at least ask people, how are you feeling? How are you? And I really mean it. And they say, fine. And I say, what do you mean, fine? What's happening in your life right now?
Well, I remember once going with somebody to a doctor, and the doctor spent the entire time looking in the chart and doing the numbers and the lab work and never really talked to the patient.
Right.
But I guess the doctor doesn't have time to look at the chart and to do all the studying and everything when the patient's not there, and that they're getting paid for their time.
Well, what's an office visit about? What's it about? It's certainly about information. I mean, you want to exchange information.
And to diagnose what's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that does make a difference, but it's also about connection, and it's about being heard, being listened to, and it's about being cared for, and we're losing some of that. We need to have feel like we have a relationship where it matters to the doctor. It's not this sterile thing where you're there just trying to fix the biochemistry and physiology of what's gone wrong. Not that that's unimportant, but it's a heck of a lot more important if you realize that those symptoms and those problems are hooked onto something called a person.
Yeah, and they all go together because you've told me before that a lot of times when you're just talking to the patient will end up what they say to you. They're telling you what's wrong with them.
For sure.
They can diagnose themselves, really, if
well,
you
they
just
do.
Listen to them.
Sure. They'll even tell you what they need.
Yeah.
If you listen long enough. And that's
you listen pretty long because I know your visits are about an hour and a half, and
I know
you're only paid an hour for an hour and a half. So.
Right, that's true. Well, it's because I care about the people that I'm with. I remember when I was at Duke Medical School and they said, you're a scientist. You have to be detached and separate from your patient. Don't do social activities with them. Make sure that this is something that's scientifically based. And I was thinking, how in the world is anybody ever going to trust you if they don't know anything about you? And don't you think it's important that you care about your patients and that you are emotionally and intellectually connected and involved?
Well, you know, the communication is healing for the
patient.
Of course.
It's
and
not the penicillin or the digitalis that's going to be... I mean, we don't have penicillin deficiencies and digitalis deficiencies. We have real problems that are caused by real situations.
Well, the doctor could also pick up some nonverbal cues about from the patient and their eye contact.
Yeah,
and
I suppose if they're not looking at the computer screen, they might.
Or might, like, how much pain they're in, like if it's hard for you to sit or something, you know?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who go to the doctor expecting to be listened to, but the doctor has got teams of people who have put together a structure for how much information and what information needs to be garnered from an office visit. And so they're busy looking at their screens, doing their checklist to make sure they've done everything so that they'll be considered doctors who have done a good job.
Well, the electronic health records are supposed to be more effective and efficient and to coordinate the care better.
Well, they will from a scientific point of view.
Yet they are distracting from the rapport and the emotional connection and the creative thinking.
Well, the electronic health records are much more of a problem than that, but I agree with you.
Well, in some ways, it seems to me like looking at the computer screen with the electronic health records and so forth is similar to a PowerPoint presentation. When I go to a lecture,
right.
Somebody does a
right.
PowerPoint.
That's all you need your doctor to do is give you a PowerPoint presentation.
I think, you know, I don't even know why I'm listening to them. They could have just handed out the outline and I could have
take
just
it
read
home.
It, you know, take it home, read it at my leisure.
Well, in medical school, a lot of the time, because it was like that, I didn't go to class. I just got the notes and I went home and studied it in my own time. And the hour that I put in doing it that way, many times was more valuable than just listening to them read off a PowerPoint presentation.
Plus, it saved you having to get ready and drive there and everything else.
That's right. Well, medicine has changed a lot in the last 50 years. It's not like the doctor's coming up with a horse and buggy and doing a service at the house and you're giving them a chicken or her a chicken in return for the visit. It's like there's a real deep personal connection with patients at that time.
Well, I don't think your patients give you chicken, but they give
some
you,
do.
Some of them give you gifts.
Well, some of them give me chicken. Okay. We had one come over today.
Oh, that's right.
All right, that counts too, doesn't it? They had cooked a meal for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is something that I think is a step forward, but also a couple of steps backwards. And for me, I would prefer that the doctor pay attention. And I know when I do a history and physical on somebody, I'll give a little extra time for notes. So what I'll do is I'll go through the whole scenario of the hour and a half time. I'll make a CD of what happened so the patient has a copy of every word that was said by both of us. And
they get it to take home.
They take it home. And then when they leave, then I write my notes. Otherwise, my most of my notes are just blank. and I try to fit it together. And I don't worry too much about the notes, it's because I've got the CD. So that's how that works. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Zabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on how to get started to reduce environmental toxin exposures. And when we come back after that, we'll be talking about, can omega-3 fatty acids improve your sleep? And can inadequate sleep increase the heart attack, stroke, and type 2 diabetes in adolescents?
It's important to get the toxins and the chemicals out of your life. And you might want to just start slow, because I'm going to be going over several things, but maybe you can just start out with just maybe picking one thing a month to change, you
sure.
know? So, like, for example, you might want to get rid of some chemical fertilizers or herbicides or fungicides, because mm-hmm. those are known to cause health problems, and including cancer and nervous system and reproductive disorders. So, and maybe you could just not buy things with synthetic chemicals, or eliminate one plastic container from your pantry, that kind of a thing. Maybe pick one personal care product like deodorant or toothpaste that's a healthier one, or your makeup and so forth. So let's start talking about the artificial sweeteners. Those are really good to stay away from, especially aspartame, which is also found in NutraSweet and Equal. And it's oftentimes in Diet Coke, it is in Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi, and it's often in sugar-free gums, candies, yogurts, breakfast cereals,
right.
all kinds of things, Kool-Aid, Jell-O pudding, popsicles, and so forth. And now there's a link between aspartame and brain lesions that was found in multiple sclerosis patients and aspartame. And it can help you gain weight. And I can go on and on and on. So that's one of them.
Right.
So another thing is to eat organic produce if you can.
Right.
Because they don't, on the most part, have pesticides in them, as well as they don't have those fertilizers, herbicides, and fungicides that I was talking about that can cause health problems. And plus, it's a higher nutritional value. Also, avoid food additives. When I say food additives, these are synthetic chemicals that are added to food. And there's at least 100 new synthetic additives added to our food supply every year, so it's important to read the ingredients. And some of the food additives are like colorings. And with Easter coming up, you know, you might want to pay a little bit more attention to that, especially if your kids have allergies. Food colorings are also suspected carcinogens, according to the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Blue 1 and 2, green 3, red 3, and yellow 6 that are found in beverages, candies, baked goods, all that. They're poorly tested, and also preservatives in bread and baked goods are known to cause ADHD behavior in lab animals anyway. Use chemical-free cosmetics and personal care products. I'm a big advocate of that. We have a section devoted to that on drsaputo.com. If you just put in the search box, library search box, safe skincare products, and it'll pop up in Vicki's corner.
That's invaluable, and it's wonderful. It gives 800 numbers you can call, and it gives websites so you can get information.
Also, so use natural chemical-free body products and cosmetics with the fewest and the safest ingredients, and watch out especially for parabens and the chemicals DEA and BHT that are used as a solvent, lipstick, and nail polish, and so forth. And there's others that are on my list. I also have a list of some of the toxins to avoid, but there are 25,000, so they're certainly not all on there.
Right.
But there are a lot of dangers with synthetic fragrances, and it's tempting, but don't use them. It's better to use an essential oil if you're not allergic to the essential oil. But avoid the synthetically or artificially scented air fresheners, including the aerosols and the plug-ins. And they contain phthalates. Those are the synthetic fragrances. And they can cause hormonal abnormalities and birth defects and reproductive problems. And the list goes on here. There's a lot of things here. Some of these chemicals in one product, especially the secret fragrance mixtures,
mm-hmm.
they can have like hundreds of chemicals in one product. And they can contain neurotoxins. And they're very allergenic. Okay, don't take clean to an extreme. Cleaning products. Cleaning products can be very toxic and hazardous to your health. And they're linked to asthma and allergies and other things that are unhealthy. And I'm talking like bleach and disinfectants and, and triclosan that's found in antibacterial soap, to deodorant, toothpaste, acne cream. It's really actually a pesticide, and it's an endocrine disruptor. So look for the word antibacterial, and it's better to avoid it. Your tap water is contaminated with prescription and over-the-counter drugs, and like antibiotics, pain medicines, antidepressants, sex hormones, all right. that. Small concentrations over time, just, you know, continuously can harm us. So that's not a good thing to do either. And avoid plastic, like the BPA with the plastic water bottles and the other plastic food containers and canned foods. Even receipts, ATM receipts and cash register receipts. Isn't this something? It's like, yeah, we can't get away from all these.
That's right.
I guess that's why some people that work at a cash register use rubber gloves.
That's one reason. That's
and be
right.
aware of how much use, you know, with your cordless phone and your cell phones and all that, because and even being on your computer because of electromagnetic fields. So, like I said, just take it slow and pick something a month, once a month maybe. And a great book to learn more about all this is Beth Greer's Supernatural Home.
Great
and
book.
Also Vicki's Corner on drsaputo.com.
Highly recommend both sites.
Okay, that was a lot to try to get in. I've been talking so fast. Now everybody's been hearing about omega-3s and
right.
how important they are to be healthy.
Exactly.
Well, chickens are even eating them. We see pricey omega-3 eggs in the grocery store now. I think I even saw them in Safeway.
Right.
They have a lot of crucial functions in the body. And now a new study shows that the DHA and omega-3s helps promote sleep. What a healthy sleeping aid. Pass the salmon, please.
Yeah, indeed. Well, this was a study done at the University of Oxford. It was published in the journal Sleep Research in March of 2014. And they looked at 362 kids who were between the ages of 7 and 9 in a UK school for children who were doing pretty well. And basically what they found is that those kids that had a higher level of DHA were sleeping better. And a lot of the kids weren't sleeping better. In fact, about 4 out of 10 kids were suffering from regular sleep disturbances. So it's interesting to make the association. When you have 40% of the kids who have clinical level sleep problems and are also noted to have higher levels of DHA when they're doing better, there's something to pay attention to.
Yeah, it makes me think, too, it might be calming them down, because I know that this is healthy for kids that have ADD or ADHD, too.
Absolutely. The whole business of essential fatty acid defects for kids with ADD is a huge thing. David Horobin probably published close to 2,000 papers in his life. And what he found is that there were a lot of kids with ADD and ADHD who couldn't convert the alpha-linolenic acid that's found in seeds and nuts, or the linoleic acid that's found in seeds and nuts and vegetables, into the down-chain metabolites that are important in terms of producing DHA and EPA and GLA, which are all important in kids who have ADD, because it leads to problems in night blindness, hyperactivity, in dehydration, because their skin isn't waterproof. They tend to have a problem with night vision defects. They can't catch a ball right, they're dyslexic. So all these things centered around omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids.
And doesn't low DHA also lead to low melatonin? And we talked about that last time.
Yes, there's good evidence that that's a relationship. And, of course, we know that without melatonin, we don't sleep well. That's the sleep hormone made by the pineal gland that rises just about an hour before we go to bed.
You know, many times there's confusion over bad and then healthy fats, and a lot of people don't get it because fats for so many years got such a bad rap. But we really do need them, and especially the healthy ones. We don't want the trans fats.
Right.
And those are the partially hydrogenated fats.
But you definitely need some saturated fat. There's no question about that.
Like coconut oil is a good one.
Coconut oil is good, and some of it's good coming from other kinds of vegetables and meats as well. When we look at the functions of essential fatty acids, there are all kinds of things that they do. that range.
Well, let's talk about the omega-3s, especially, because that's what we were talking about for improving the quality of sleep.
Yeah, well, that's true. The omega-3s, for sure, but the omega-6s as well, Vicki, do a lot of very good things, like serve for energy production, and it increases stamina in people who are athletes, sometimes by 40 or 50%. We heal quicker.
So what are the omega-6s in?
They're mostly found in a lot of vegetables, and we find those in refined oils. The problem is that a lot of the omega-6s that we consume have been ruined by the processing of them to make the oil. So
we
don't
recommend them. So we want expeller-pressed or cold-pressed. You don't want them forced out with chemicals or high heat.
That's right. So it's a good idea to make sure that you're getting healthy omega-6s. Otherwise, it creates problems. But
the omega-3s, where do we get the omega-3s? That's mostly from fish and what else?
Seeds and nuts are a good place to get it.
And I guess those special eggs.
Yeah, and flaxseed oil is a good place to get both omega-3 and 6s. Mm-hmm. When we consume fish, basically all we get are the omega-3s. We get the DHA and EPA from those sources. But altogether, those omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids are important for energy production and brain function, for skin, hair, and nails. They help prevent cancer.
For vision?
Yeah.
It even works as an antiarrhythmic for your heart and an anticoagulant.
It's one of the most important medicines to take if you have heart disease, to keep your heart rhythm in a rhythm that's good. In fact, there aren't many medicines that work more powerfully than fish oil to suppress those rhythm disturbances.
And it's great that it works for joint pain.
It's got all kinds of things that it does. And if you go to the drsubuda.com website, what you'll find there, if you put omega-3 fatty acids, is probably 50 or 100 short audios and videos that will describe to you more information.
I just quickly wanted to talk about some of the causes for insomnia in kids, because I think parents need to be aware of it. Most of them are the reasons why adults can't sleep either, but pain, anxiety, depression, fear, sleep apnea,
oh, yeah,
all their technology that they like to play with, and diet.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so we've got more on sleep problems. So if you're having trouble sleeping, you certainly aren't alone. But inadequate sleep can be hazardous to your health, and recent research shows it can predict a high risk for heart disease, diabetes, and stroke in obese adolescents from 11 to 17 years of age.
Right, so this is starting at a very young age, and it was published in the Journal of Pediatrics, in March of 2014.
So we already know that there's health risks from being obese, and if you add lack of sleep, it increases the risk for inflammation and reduced immunity, and then advanced disease, which is pretty scary.
Right, and this study was done out of the University of Michigan Health System and Baylor University. They studied 37 obese adolescents that were between the age of 11 and 17, and what they did is they tracked them with a physical activity monitor that they wore 24 hours a day for 7 days, and then they looked to see how these kids slept. And they found that most of the participants slept about 7 hours a night, and only in 5 of them did they get the 8.5 hours that they needed. So
I want to know what kid that age gets 8.5 hours sleep. Maybe the 11-year-old.
Maybe not.
But you know, when you get up early for school and they have all this homework and everything, uh-huh, I mean, it's really a setup for not getting enough sleep. When I was in high school, I don't think I ever got more than 6 hours sleep a night.
Yeah, well, it's amazing you turned out like you did, right? But yet at the same time, we're looking at these kids, and the ones that are not getting enough sleep, their levels of inflammation go way up. Their immunity goes down. They have an increased risk, as we were talking about, for diabetes and hypertension and osteoporosis, heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. So the list really goes on, and it's an important thing to pay attention to.
Well, you know, some of the teen problems that might keep them awake, too, especially if they are obese, it could be the stress from being bullied, too.
There are a lot of reasons why kids don't sleep. I mean, it's
home problems, also poor diet and caffeine and sugar and medicines and ADD drugs.
Right.
And not getting enough exercise. A lot of kids that are overweight, it's one of the reasons is they don't get enough exercise.
All right. Well, we're at the end of the show. We got more to talk about, but no time. So we want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we talked about in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the DrSaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
See you next time.